One of the members of the crew that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima thought the bomb looked like an elongated trash can with fins. It was 10.5 feet long, 29 inches in diameter, and weighed 9,700 pounds. When it exploded over the city of Hiroshima in 1945, it brought the world into a new era of science and a new era of warfare. My guest Richard Rhodes is the author of the new book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, a history of the science, politics, and human drama behind the first nuclear weapons. The book won a 1987 National Book Award. This week, it won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. I spoke with Rhodes earlier today from station KCUR in Kansas City. He told me why he wanted to write this book.
I had a political reason, and I also had a literary reason. Politically, it seemed to me that I might try to make some contribution to the movement to deal with the whole issue of nuclear weapons. And as I thought that through, I realized I really wasn't someone who might march in the streets or carry signs, but I write books, and that I might somehow, by writing about how all this began, shed some light on where we are today. In terms of literary issues, here was what is perhaps the great tragic epic of the 20th century, mankind inventing the means of its own destruction. And I didn't see, looking through the literature, that anyone had tried to tell the entire story on that epic scale that it seemed to me it deserved.
You write that to blame the scientists for nuclear weapons confuses the message with the messenger. Would you explain that?
Well, they didn't invent nuclear energy any more than earlier physicists invented electricity. It was there always lurking in matter, waiting for a time when we had reached a point of understanding of how the world works to prize it out. Robert Oppenheimer said once to his physicists right after the end of the Second World War that the deep things in science, he said, are not found because they're something we want. They're found because they're there to be found. So these men didn't inflict this energy upon us. They simply found a way to prize it out, and it became then a political issue and is still a political issue. So I don't think we should blame the physicists.
You actually, I think, paint a very poignant picture of the young physicist who worked on the creation of the atom bomb. These are physicists who were used to living in a very theoretical world, and suddenly they were thrust into a very real world, a world in which they were creating the most destructive bomb in the history of man, and they really weren't used to that kind of work.
Physics before World War II was such an arcane science that one physicist, a friend of mine, said that when he got his PhD in physics, he would go to a cocktail party and someone would say, "What do you do?" And he would say, "I'm a chemist." Here then, suddenly, they were thrust into one of the darkest and most painful parts of the world, working on weapons of terrible mass destruction. And they felt that contrast keenly. They felt their responsibility to try to understand what they were doing and what the moral issues were quite keenly, even in the context of a brutal war when everyone in this country was trying as hard as possible to find ways to bring it to an end.
Many of the physicists who were working on the bomb had strong political feelings about how the bomb should or should not be used. Physicist Niels Bohr actually wrote to FDR that in order to prevent eventual nuclear war, that the U.S. should share its secrets with the Soviet Union to prevent what he called competition grounded in insecurity. Did he actually go so far as to share some of the information about the bomb with his Soviet counterparts?
No, although I think Winston Churchill was afraid he might. And I must clarify, I think that Bohr has been unfairly accused of contemplating sharing the secrets of the technology with the Soviet Union. He never did propose that. He talked to Roosevelt, he talked to Churchill about the necessity of understanding that this weapon was going to be eventually a common danger to all mankind, which is what it's become. And that sitting down before the arms race that would otherwise be inevitable began Mike forestalled that arms race. He had the hope that these leaders in wartime who had seen such devastation, who understood what that devastation meant, might be able to sit down and agree on some sort of controls before the whole thing started, which, of course, is not what happened. So Bohr wasn't proposing sharing the secrets of the bombs such as they were. He was proposing sharing the fact that such a weapon would soon exist and trying to deal with the political consequences of that weapon.
Richard Rhodes is my guest. He's the author of the book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. You describe what it was like for the physicists when they viewed the first bomb test, when they viewed their theory actually going off in practice. Now, they really didn't know what to expect, and I think the point that really brings that home is the dollar wager that they all made with each other.
Yes. Well, there was at least a very, very small possibility that some unknown physical effect might lead to this uranium, or rather plutonium bomb that was tested in the desert in southern New Mexico, igniting the atmosphere and blowing up the world. And although they knew that the chances were extremely remote because they had worked the numbers thoroughly over and over again, there was still the vague possibility. So in that sort of gallows humor spirit, they had a betting pool on the size of the bomb and what might happen.
And the bets ran, the one physicist bet that it would be a 300-ton explosion, and someone else said, no, it would be the equivalent of 45,000 tons. It just really seemed to me they really had no idea
That had a lot to do with the kind of technology. It was a whole new way of setting off a massive material, and they just weren't sure how efficient the design would be. In fact, I noticed that the bomb that was tested in New Mexico was about 4 kilotons smaller in yield than the one that was exploded at supposedly identical over Nagasaki. So there was some variety there.
They wanted to actually be able to see the bomb going off. How are they equipped to view? Some of them were actually wearing welder's masks. Did they have kind of protection?
Well, Edward Teller had done his numbers carefully and thought the bomb might be more explosive than it turned out to be. So he brought along, in the middle of a cold desert night, and 20 miles away he was stationed, he brought along a bottle of suntan lotion and covered himself with it and passed it around. It was rather chilling to the New York Times reporter who was there to see these famous scientists in the darkness of the night putting on suntan lotion.
Well, Taylor, you quote Teller as saying, we were told to turn our faces away from the blast, but we wanted to look the beast in the eye.
Right. Yes, indeed. Teller described the effect of the bomb going off once he pulled off his welder's glasses as being rather like drawing heavy drapes on a flood of morning sunlight. Another physicist, Philip Morrison, noticed more not the light, which he said we all expected a very bright flash of light, but the fact that although Morrison was 5 miles away, he said it felt as if someone had just thrown open the door on a hot oven.
There's a quote from one of the physicists, I. Robbie, that you use in your book, and I was wondering if I could ask you to read that quote for us. This is one of the physicists describing what he saw when the first bomb test.
Maybe we could call this a memorial. Maybe we could call this a memorial. Dr. Robbie died yesterday in New York City at the age of 89. This is what he wrote the morning of the test at Trinity Site in New Mexico, July 16th, 1945. We were lying there very tense in the early dawn, and there were just a few streaks of gold in the east. You could see your neighbor very dimly. Those 10 seconds were the longest 10 seconds that I ever experienced. Suddenly, there was an enormous flash of light, the brightest light I have ever seen or that I think anyone has ever seen. It blasted, it pounced, it bored its way right through you. It was a vision which was seen with more than the eye. It was seen to last forever. You would wish it to stop. Altogether, it lasted about 2 seconds. Finally, it was over, diminishing, and we looked toward the place where the bomb had been. There was an enormous ball of fire which grew and grew, and it rolled as it grew. It went up into the air in yellow flashes and into scarlet and green. It looked menacing. It seemed to come toward one. A new thing had just been born, a new control, a new understanding of man, which man had acquired over nature.
I think there was really quite a range of emotional reactions that the physicists experienced when they saw the creation actually explode. What was that range of emotion?
I think everything from hope to terror, because of the magnitude of the explosion, because it seemed to go on rolling and echoing back and forth from the mountains that framed this flat, high piece of desert land. Hope because they had all, or at least the most thoughtful among them, had come to understand even at that early date that this weapon was going to bring an end to all-out world war, which it has done, I think, and that it was going to force the nation states with all the belligerence of their political system that led to war after war after war over the 200 years since the nation state really came into existence. It was going to force the nation states to find some accommodation with each other, as in fact, again, I think it has. They knew that then, and so there was a measure of hope in what they were doing, even though they also knew that these weapons would very shortly destroy hundreds of thousands of human lives.
You write in depth about the targeting committee who chose the sites in Japan that the bombs would be dropped on. What kind of guidelines was the targeting committee given?
They were instructed to look for a city that was flat enough and open enough in its territory and undamaged enough that the effects of the bomb could be measured in a real battle situation. It was a painful piece of ambiguity all during the Second World War about targeting our bombers. We had originally began as with an air force that was intended to be used for precision pinpoint bombing, and that myth was maintained really throughout the Second World War, and I think there are probably many Americans who still believe it. But the bomb sites were not accurate enough, and the bombers couldn't get in position accurately enough to drop bombs precisely. This was particularly true in Japan, where the B-29s were flying it up where the jet stream was. The jet stream was apparently discovered at that point, and it blew the planes off course. We simply couldn't bomb the aircraft factories and the ball-bearing factories that we hoped we could. And rather than give up the use of a multi-million dollar weapons system, strategic bombers, we decided to bomb cities in general on the sort of theory that if you're going to destroy a factory, well, the workers are kind of soldiers in the factory, so they're combatants too. So from 1939, when we appealed to the belligerents, Germany and England, not to bomb cities, to 1945, when we were bombing Japanese cities with firebombs and actually destroyed totally 66 Japanese cities by the end of the Second World War, we had reached a point where targets were the center of cities, not factories on the margins or anything else. And in that baleful spirit, the targeting committee tried to find a place where the bomb, one for each city, could be dropped to demonstrate what sort of damage it would cause. And Hiroshima was the first choice of the first meeting of the first of the target committee, and continued to be throughout.
What made Hiroshima the first choice?
Well, Hiroshima was a delta city. It's the place where the river, the Ota River, fans out into seven tributaries. It's flat, and it was there, simply. It was still there. Hiroshima had not been bombed yet. We had firebombed and destroyed so many cities that it was difficult to find targets that met the criteria that were proposed. So it was chosen because it was available and because it was still undamaged.
Well, I want to talk with you about the actual dropping of the bomb, but first we're going to take a short break. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Richard Rhodes, who is the author of the book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. It just won a National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. Earlier this year, it won a National Book Award. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Rhodes is my guest, the author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb. One thing that's always amazed me seeing pictures of the atomic bomb is how small it looks.
Well, yes, and in fact, the actual plutonium core of the Nagasaki bomb was about the size of an orange. It doesn't take, I mean, there's so much energy locked up in matter, it doesn't take very much of it to produce an enormous explosion.
The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima came equipped with graffiti, little messages that people in America wrote on the tail of the bomb. Who wrote the graffiti and what did it say?
I wasn't able to find out what it said. I gather some of it was obscene, some of it said up the emperor, whatever, the sort of thing that soldiers and mechanics would write on the tail of a bomb they were about to drop. That was a pretty common experience during the Second World War. We took those things personally. There's a photograph that shows the Fat Man bomb, the Nagasaki bomb, that with graffiti on the tail, but unfortunately the words aren't quite resolvable. I guess it's lost to history.
You quote the description that Paul Tibbetts, a pilot and the group commander for the raid on Hiroshima, you quote him describing flying, dropping the bomb and then flying past as the bomb exploded. I'm going to ask you to read that quote.
Yes, Tibbetts directed the training of the bombing group and was, in fact, the pilot for the Hiroshima mission. After the war, he wrote, this is just as the bomb has fallen from the bomb bay of the B-29 at 31,000 feet. I threw off the automatic pilot and hauled Enola Gay, that was the name of the plane, Enola Gay into the turn. I pulled anti-glare goggles over my eyes. I couldn't see through them. I was blind. I threw them to the floor. A bright light filled the plane. The first shock wave hit us. We were 11 and a half miles slant range from the atomic explosion, but the whole airplane cracked and crinkled from the blast. I yelled, "Flak!" thinking a heavy gun battery had found us. The tail gunner had seen the first wave coming, a visible shimmer in the atmosphere, but he didn't know what it was until it hit. When the second wave came, he called out a warning. We turned back to look at Hiroshima. The city was hidden by that awful cloud, boiling up, mushrooming, terrible and incredibly tall. No one spoke for a moment, then everyone was talking. I remember Lewis, his co-pilot, pounding me on the shoulder, saying, "Look at that, look at that, look at that." Tom Farabee, who was the bombardier, wondered about whether radioactivity would make us all sterile. Lewis said he could taste atomic fission. He said it tasted like lead.
What had these pilots been told to expect that they would experience when they dropped the bomb?
Well, Tibbetts, first of all, had actually seen the films from the test in the desert and had been thoroughly briefed. He'd made many trips to Los Alamos during the time the bombs were being built. He didn't tell his crews anything until they were out on Tinian Island, 1,500 miles from Japan, just a couple days before the actual bomb run. They were aware that they were going to do something rather unusual because they had been practicing the rather bizarre activity of taking their huge B-29s. The B-29 was the largest bomber ever built up to that time. It had the wingspan almost as large as a football field. Taking their B-29s into a sudden 180-degree diving turn that came very close to the stress limits on the wings of the aircraft. This was designed to gain speed and to get them away from the atomic explosion at least 10 miles away between the time the bomb left the bomb bay and the time it exploded 1,800 yards above ground. So they knew something was up, and they were getting away from something that must be an extraordinarily powerful explosion. But they didn't know that the bomb was an atomic bomb until they were actually airborne and flying the Hiroshima mission. Then Tibbetts told them, and they were understandably awed.
Was that information withheld so that they wouldn't betray any secrets, or so that they wouldn't be too scared to fly the mission?
No, it was secrets that were involved, yes. This entire program, which involved the work of 100,000 people in the United States, was maintained with truly extraordinary secrecy throughout the Second World War.
We discussed a little bit the range of reactions that the physicist at Los Alamos felt after the first test of the atom bomb went off. What was the range of reactions when reports came back to Los Alamos that the bomb had actually exploded on Hiroshima?
Some of the physicists feeling that they had contributed to an early end to a bloody and brutal war celebrated. They went out to dinner at the La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe. Some were so shocked to realize that what they had done had killed 140,000 human beings that they went out in the bushes and threw up. That was the range. They were all, I think, stunned by the reality of what had not been quite real before, as we all are when something that we've worked on suddenly has massive consequences.
Your book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, has just won two very prestigious awards. I think what makes this book important is not only the incredible details that you've managed to put together in telling the complete story of the making of the atomic bomb, but also the fact that a lot of the main players in this drama are in the latter years of their life and won't be around to tell their story much longer.
It's been a saddening and moving experience to meet these men and then to discover later that they have died. I've now seen the deaths of three of the people that I've met and interviewed for the book. Yesterday, as I mentioned earlier, Isidore Isaac Rabi, one of the great physicists of the 20th century, a wonderful man who ran a great school of physics at Columbia University and who was, to some extent, perhaps the conscience of the atomic scientists, a rabbinical man, a man of great wit and great humor, and a man who didn't easily suffer fools, but was part and parcel of all this activity, and now he's gone to us, he's lost to us. This story is on the cusp of history, and maybe that's why it still has so much force for us, because it happened only yesterday. I was 8 years old. I remember vividly the photograph in the Kansas City Star, where I live in Kansas City, Missouri, of the mushroom cloud over Hiroshima. And yet, so much has happened since then. It's had such enormous consequences for the world that it also must seem a little bit as if this has always been with us.
What surprised you most in the research of this book? You knew something of the story of the atom bomb before you started to write the book, I'm sure. But in actually finding out all the details and doing the investigations that you did and speaking to the people who were involved in the making of the bomb who you spoke to, what elements really surprised you?
I think, well, there's something that something large and something perhaps that's just a part of the history of the story. Maybe they're connected. I went into this with a very strong feeling that there might be no hope for us all. The arms race is certainly something that can lead anyone to feel that way if they're inclined to be pessimistic. And what I discovered is that whole other side that some of the great physicists who worked on this weapon had thought their way through to even before the end of the war, the side that although this is danger for all mankind, it also in a paradoxical way is a source of great hope because it is and has and I think will continue to force the nation states to find another way to settle their grievances. That connected to something curious. One of the heroes of the whole story is a Danish physicist named Niels Bohr, who was one of the two probably greatest physicists with Einstein of the 20th century. I was fascinated to discover that Bohr's essential way of looking at some of the very basic physics that he did as a scientist traces very directly back to his early reading of Søren Kierkegaard, of all the strange people you might think connected with Bohr's realization that the atom was of a certain design, for example, is connected with his understanding of some of Kierkegaard's ideas about religion. And to find the preeminent 19th century philosopher of existentialism, of angst, of anxiety and dread, deeply, deeply connected to the story of the bomb and of the release of nuclear energy into the world was an extraordinary connection that I was fascinated by.
You said that there was something kind of light or almost trivial, is that the word you use?
Well, not trivial, but I mean the Kierkegaard connection is perhaps not central to things, but it's a rather deep connection that no one had come across before.
Do you feel changed by having found out what you did about the bomb?
Very much so. Very much so. Because I came away with this with a sense of hope. I came away with a feeling that this might have been one of the finest things that ever happened to our species.
Yet you say it in the end of the book, the necessity now is to begin to dismantle the death machine.
The death machine, referring to the entire vast overkilling mechanism that we've managed to put together over the last 42 years, because we were so afraid, because the nation states give up their sovereignty so with such reluctance, so grudgingly, we have built and continue to build. So the arms race, in fact, is ongoing, and I think that's the danger now. I think the danger to us all is the danger of accident, either mechanical accident, mechanical failure, the computers fouling up, or the kind of accident by which World War I began, where things just got out of hand and nobody quite knew how to stop them. That, I think, is our risk now, not the risk of someone declaring war.
Well, I want to congratulate you on the National Book Critics Circle Award that you just
thank
won
you.
For your new book. And I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your time with us today and for talking with us about the making of the atomic bomb. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Richard Rhodes. His book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, just won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Last November, it won the National Book Award. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.